Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, December 14th, 2005. This is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. With me this week, as always, are the skeptical rogues, Perry DeAngelis.
Hello.
Bob Novella.
Good evening.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hello, everyone.
So we are full on into the holiday season.
Yep.
And along with all of the Santa Clauses and holiday trees and decorations are the scammers. The Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, and other state consumer protection agencies are putting out warnings about the most common scams which are out there. My favorite of the ones that I read is the jury duty scam. I hadn't heard about that one before. Have any of you heard of that one?
No, what's that about?
Nope.
A caller, you know, calls up people on the phone and angrily tells them that they missed their jury duty assignment. And then in order to straighten out what this logistical mess that involves the person, you know, giving the caller their social security number and bank account numbers, or why they would want their bank account numbers, I can't imagine. So they just put people off their guard by, you know, accusing them of missing their jury duty.
Right.
It's actually clever because that's something that, you know, people can be a little anxious about. It's
then
possible.
Everyone has to do eventually.
Yeah, everyone has to do. You could, you know, you get this letter, maybe you forgot the letter or missed it in the mail or something, and suddenly you're, you know, in trouble, you know, getting hollered at because you didn't do your jury duty. So while they're on the defensive, they're not thinking that they're being scammed, and they, you know, give up their social security number. That's a pretty good one.
An angry call. I mean,
angry call. Chutzpah.
Really?
The bottom line is never, ever, ever give out any identifying information over the phone. Never your never any piece of your social security number. Remember, most of the social security number can be derived by the date and time of your birth. And location, the time and location of your birth. So,
particularly when you are called.
Right. When somebody calls you, it doesn't matter what they say. Doesn't matter who they claim to be, what story they give you. You never give them any information over the phone. And of course, now the same applies by email. If you get an unsolicited email, it doesn't matter what it says or even how legitimate it works. You never respond, especially with any identifying information. No legitimate organization is going to ask you for your bank account number over a phone or email. It's just not going to happen.
If you think there's any possibility that there's some legitimacy to it, hang up, get the number yourself, and call back.
Independently, get the number.
Right. Call the jury administration yourself.
Right.
Exactly.
Get the number independently and then call them back, you know, if you're still unsure. But at the very least, take that precaution.
There's a lot of scams this season involving the Medicare prescription drug plan. Seniors are apparently a little overwhelmed and confused about all the multitude of choices. So there are scammers making, again, unsolicited phone calls or sending spam emails selling bogus prescription plans. And there they basically warn that legitimate companies cannot spam, and they have to obey the do not call lists. And again, as you say, you should independently verify that. You can call 1-800-MEDICARE to verify any plan before you sign up for it, certainly before you give anybody money or give anybody any kind of identifying information.
Well, just the other day, my wife and I got an email that said it was from FEMA, actually from a third party working in FEMA's name, about some issues concerning her family in New Orleans. And we read the email, and I was suspicious. So rather than just reply to the email or call the number in the email, we went to the FEMA website, were able to verify some things that were in the email, and then we called ourselves a separate FEMA number. And we verified, in fact, it was a true email. But, you know, we certainly didn't take it for granted.
Right. Mm-hmm. And here's another tip with your email program. Look for a setting such that you don't automatically download the pictures that might be part of an email, because just the fact that your email is downloading the images lets them know that this, you know, what your IP address is and that your email address is a valid one. Have
right.
it set so that you have to specifically, you know, right-click the email and download the images yourself. That's a very good precaution because you don't want to let them know that it's a valid email address.
A lot of spam emails also include at the bottom, if you want to be removed from this list, click here.
God.
Never click here because that's just a way of verifying that your email address is active and legitimate. That just gets you on more lists, in fact. So never, in fact, you know, basically never click a link in spam email that you get because
right.
all sorts of nefarious things can happen.
Here's another good one that I do. We might have mentioned this earlier, but if they give you a link in the email, put your mouse pointer over the link, and the bottom of your screen in the status bar on the bottom, the information bar, should list for you where that link is going to take you. And a lot of times, it's completely different from the link that they're advertising in the email. It's usually something, you know, it's like an IP address.
May just be numbers, yeah.
Yeah, slash like PayPal.com or Amazon. So they just created that directory on their website. So if they don't match, definitely don't click that link.
Right. Here's one that's kind of scary because this would seem very benign. You get a coupon for a trial offer or for a discount on some product. That seems innocuous enough. We use coupons all the time.
In the mail.
Right, in the mail, maybe an electronic coupon over email. But what some scammers are doing is that they are setting up an account with a legitimate retailer and then issuing these bogus coupons. And when you activate the coupon, all that does is it triggers the release of consumer financial information to the scammer.
Hmm.
So it's just the retailer's legitimate,
wow.
They're just a dupe. They're just a dupe middleman in this scam. And again, it's just another, it's, you know, just a type of what we call phishing scam, which is just a way of these scammers to get your financial information. And then the worst case scenario is that leads to identity theft. Identity theft, basically somebody has enough identifying information about you that they could take out credit cards in your name, they could open up bank accounts in your name, they could absolutely destroy your credit history, you know, even force people into bankruptcy. It takes years, apparently, to undo, you know, all of the damage that's done and go through the red tape of completely getting back all of your, you know, identifying information. So it's, you know, for the computer savvy person, you could pretty, you know, just keep somewhat abreast of these scams. Don't click links you're not supposed to click. You know, you could protect yourself. The thing that really scares me are a lot of the not so savvy users that are out there, like all of our parents, for example, who are like barely able to really use their email and use the internet, and they're really a setup for a lot of these scams. And it's of course always heartening to know that the holiday season and the holiday spirit just produces an increase in this fraud.
People are, you know, they're inured with a sense of giving and a, you know, a sense of generosity, the benevolence of the season, and it puts them in a bad way.
They also may be rushed. You know, we're all
true.
In a shopping frenzy. You know, maybe you might have your guard down. So, happy holidays, everyone.
There's your little gift from the Skeptical Society.
Right. Don't you believe it.
Ever.
We have a science or fiction this week, and for the second time, Bob is going to be doing the science or fiction, and I'll be part of the panel guessing the correct answer. So, Bob, take it away.
It's time to play Science or Fiction.
Okay, there is no theme. The first one is German shoppers kill Santa Claus.
Now, before we go on, let me just say, science or fiction, we come up with three science news items or facts. Two are real, one is fake. So Bob made up a fake one. He's going to present us two real ones and one fake one, and Evan Perry and I will try to guess which of the three is the fake one.
Right.
Okay, so the first one is German shoppers kill Santa Claus.
It's about a Santa side.
In Germany, two men who had a long day of Christmas shopping, ran into a Santa Claus that was kind of off duty but still in character and wearing his clothing, and there were some words between them, and something happened, and these German shoppers killed them. The second one is that for some species of bats, bigger brains means smaller testes and vice versa. There's an inverse relationship between, in certain species of bats, between
brains and testes.
Brains and testicles.
Okay.
Some of them, if they have a huge package, their brains are small, and vice versa. And the third one is women's menstrual cycle actually changes the wiring of women's brains. New research suggests.
The wiring. Okay.
All right.
So, Evan, you go first.
You know, that first one is interesting, yet sadly believable. I don't think there's much there that sends up a red flag in my mind saying that, you know, it's certainly possible that they could have, killed Santa. Who knows what other mitigating circumstances were involved. So I'll tend to believe that one. It's the second one that is ringing a bell in my head because the ratio of the brains to the size of to the testicles, there's an inverse relationship. But, you know, that only accounts for male bats. What sort of accountability is there on female bats, right? So that one sounds a little incomplete to me. I think I'm going to guess that B is false. The third one sounds plausible, so I'll say B is false.
Perry.
Yeah. And the third one, what do you mean by wiring?
I shall not elaborate.
Okay.
Well, you know what the wiring of the brain is.
Oh, sure.
The menstrual cycle, the claim is, actually changes the wiring of women's brains.
I'll guess that one's false. Number three seems a little too extreme.
Steve.
Yeah, the first one, you know, I guess I'll just say that's okay. There's not really any way to judge the plausibility of that. I mean, so some guys killed Santa.
Certainly costumes never stopped anyone from killing anybody.
Nah. the second one is, again, certainly interesting. I have not heard anything about that. I can't think of any reason off the top of my head why there would be such a relationship. But it's nothing implausible about it. Now, the third one about the women's menstrual cycle and the hardwiring of the brain, certainly, I'm sure there are known hormonal effects on brain function. And if you did, you know, PET scans or functional MRI scans of women at different times of their menstrual cycle, I'm sure there are differences. Whether or not that counts as quote-unquote wiring,
right,
is another story. It really depends on how loosely that concept is being used. Does that mean new patterns of neuronal connections or just different levels of activity in different parts of the brain, different neurotransmitter function? So I think if you interpret that loosely, I'm pretty sure that is in fact correct. So I, with that caveat, I'll say that the third one is correct, and I'll go along with Evan and say that number two is fiction.
Okay, interesting. Okay, let's start with, how do you usually do it, Steve? You just go
number
with,
one, because
well, everyone agrees that number one is real. Is that real?
No, it is not. German shoppers did not kill Santa. It's Santa Claus. Who would kill Santa Claus?
So we all got it wrong. Oh,
I thought it was an old song. I saw Germans killing Santa Claus. Oh, no.
No.
Wait, sorry. No. Wrong song.
But they're European, Bob. I mean, come on.
I know. There's that. But, you know, they beat him up, but they didn't kill him.
I see. They beat him up.
So it's interesting. The story's funny. This guy's still in character. He's chatting with the other passengers on the train. And his two guys there, allegedly stressed out after a full day of Christmas shopping.
Yeah.
They lost their patience when Santa Claus asked them, "Tell Santa Claus what you want for Christmas." They lost it.
Oh.
They took his sack of whatever was
props,
in his sack,
yeah.
Props, booze, I don't know what was in there. They beat him over the head with it. They broke his fingers as he's tried to protect himself.
Defensive wounds, huh?
Yeah, this guy said, the guy said, around this time of year, shoppers seem to get this glint in their eyes, and you just can't, and you could just see that they're going to go off any minute. But then he said, I should have known better, but come on, who beats up Santa Claus? And they can't find the guys. They have no clue as to their identity. So they didn't kill Santa, they just beat the crap out of Santa. Now, so that means the other ones were true.
The other two were true, yeah.
The other two were true. The bats and balls one, number two, the second one, was, let's see, a new study from Syracuse University found a inverse relationship between the two.
Any speculation as to why that is?
Yeah, there was some. They used comparative analysis to show that male bat species that roost in larger social groups and those with promiscuous females have relatively smaller brains than species with females that are faithful to their mates. A likely explanation, I believe biologist Scott Picknick suggests, for this relationship relates to the energetic demands of producing and maintaining both brain and sperm cells. If competition for resources and food is tough, mm-hmm. then males can't afford to do both.
Right.
So they've got to pretty much pick one or the other. And an interesting ratio here, some of these male bats have an 8.5% of their body mass is taken up in their testicles, which I roughly equated to a 180-pound man having 15 pounds between his legs.
That's about right.
So that's big. I mean, inordinately big. So
speak for yourself, son.
Yeah. I thought find that interesting. The wiring one, you're right, Steve, that was ambiguous, and I carefully read the article trying to find out exactly what they meant, and here's an excerpt. The findings presented at the 2005 Society for Neuroscience meeting show that the wiring, in quotes, in the brains of female rats expands and contracts in relation to the amount of estrogen present during the menstrual cycle. Now, that's, you know, expands and contracts. I mean, that itself is ambiguous. What exactly are they?
Right.
But that's the level of detail they gave. I couldn't find anything else on that. So interpret that as you will.
I'm somewhat familiar with that type of research. And, again, there are numerous studies showing both, you know, sexual differences, individual differences, and cycle differences in terms of the various sexual hormones, especially estrogen, seems to be a very critical one.
Right.
And functions of different parts of the brain.
Yeah, I could see. Functions in different parts of the brain makes sense, but just the way they worded it, the wiring expands and contracts.
Well, I know there are differences in development, which can, in fact, affect the wiring.
Right.
But and wiring is somewhat plastic, but yeah, I'm not sure what they mean by expanding and contracting.
Yeah,
unless they're talking about just the amount of function that they're seeing, the amount of activity.
Yeah, I guess that's what they mean. But it's just
when your brain expands in your skull, it kills you.
Yeah, I'm sure they're not talking about volume expansion.
Yeah, the word choice was poor, but still, I got you guys.
You certainly did.
Yeah, you did, Bob.
Oh, I didn't think he'd bother making up a fake one about guys killing Santa, to be honest with you.
I didn't get any number of stories about Disney characters getting killed. And
it's a high-risk profession, you know, being a character actor in a cartoon costume. I'm telling you.
Brings up all sorts of childhood horror memories.
Ranks right up there with being a sports team mascot.
I would imagine that would be a bit worse.
And the horrors involved in that.
I remember I read recently that in England they were trying to come up with an anti-drinking ads for the holidays and stuff, and they actually had considered having Santa run over by a drunk driver to get their message across. They didn't actually end up doing it. They think they went with cats have nine lives, you only have one, but they thought about killing Santa. They didn't actually do it.
Then they realized that young children might be watching that on television.
And that was the end of that.
Until someone came to their senses.
So more holiday cheer from the Skeptical Society. Keeping up with the theme of this week's show.
Now, Perry, you sent me this news article from this week from Des Moines, Iowa. Girl suffers seizure after prolonged video game play.
Right.
Apparently, a young girl, after playing a video game for 5 hours straight, was found by her mother in her bedroom having a seizure. The mother's description of what she found is a pretty good description of a seizure. She was unresponsive. She was convulsing, breathing heavily, frothing at the mouth. That's a pretty good description of a seizure, so that was probably an actual seizure.
And the doctors didn't disagree when they checked her out.
I mean, you know, you go by somebody else's history. You never know for sure if you didn't see it happening by itself. You have to sort of make your diagnosis based upon the details that the person spontaneously gives. But those details are highly suspicious for a seizure. It says the doctors at the hospital concluded that long-term use of video game induced the seizure. This is interesting because do you remember a number of years ago, it's probably now 5 or 6 years ago, maybe a little bit more, there was a rash of apparent seizures of children playing Nintendo.
I remember. Yeah, it was parodied on South Park and so forth.
Yeah, The Simpsons, I think,
and
had
Simpsons,
a parody of it.
Simpsons parodied it, too.
Okay.
The Simpsons were visiting Japan. They were watching those, the fast-action flashing light, Japanimation, and they all had seizures.
There you go, yeah.
But, it's interesting because I actually peer-reviewed an article about that original episode a number of years ago, mainly in Japan. The fact is that flashing lights can, in fact, induce seizures. That is a known phenomenon. It's a phenomenon called photic driving, that the visual stimulation can cause certain groups of neurons in the brain to synchronize, and that can trigger a seizure. In fact, when we do electroencephalograms, measure the brain waves of people who are suspected of having seizures, one thing we do is subject them to strobe lights at different frequencies. It's a standard part of an EEG to see if that induces any epileptiform activity in their brain. So that's certainly very plausible, sort of a known phenomenon. Some epileptics will get seizures if they're driving and the sunlight is flickering through the trees, for example. That kind of strobe effect may trigger a seizure. But the paper that I reviewed looked at the 30 or 40 reported cases following a news report of one child that had, again, probably a real seizure playing a Nintendo game. But all of the subsequent cases, the conclusion of the article was, which I agreed with, were probably not seizures. They were probably anxiety or panic attacks, again, based upon the constellation of symptoms that were being reported. So there you had a very real plausible case of a seizure following a video game, but it caused a bit of a community panic. The idea that a lot of people are at risk for getting seizures playing these video games, and induced a rash of essentially fake seizures following that.
Okay.
This case, it's hard. It probably was a real seizure. Of course, maybe. The girl has epilepsy. Maybe she would have had a seizure in any case. The playing of the video game may not have had anything to do with it. Maybe she was allowed herself to get dehydrated or sleep deprived or low blood sugar, all things that can lower the threshold for having a seizure. The article does comment that this particular game, True Crimes Streets of New York, involves driving through the snow, and that the snowflakes can have like a strobe light effect. So that does lend a bit of plausibility to it.
I had that test done to me when I was in high school. When they thought I was hyperactive, I guess they sent me up to Yale and did a bunch of suspicious tests on me. But one of them was they put that strobe light in front of me, and the guy, I remember the young physician told me at the time, or technician, he said, okay, you're going to see patterns of colors and everything. And he was exactly right. He put that strobe light, and I remember seeing, like, these, squares of colors moving, in unison in front of my eyes. You're telling me they were trying to cause me to have a seizure?
No, that's a different test. That sounds like a visual evoked response.
Okay.
And there you use a pattern, just like you described, like a checkered pattern of colors, in order to stimulate the visual cortex and then record the delay from the stimulus to the electrical activity in the back of the brain. It's just a way of measuring the conduction, through your visual system into your brain. That's what that sounds like, what you just described. When they're trying to induce seizures, there's no pattern. It's just a flat, like a white strobe.
I think you misunderstand me. it was just a white strobe. The guy said when I looked at it, I was going to see patterns of colors, and I did.
Mm-hmm.
My recollection of it is many years ago.
Uh-huh.
My recollection of it was just a quickly flashing white strobe, but I saw patterns of colors.
You sure the patterns weren't in the strobe itself?
You know, I can't be sure.
It probably was. Most people do not see checkered patterns of colors in response to a strobe light.
Okay.
It's hard. You know, we all know how malleable and unreliable
right.
memories are. So you're digging down way deep.
I am.
I'm just trying to match it as closely as possible with the way these tests are done today. Again, the white strobe light is part of a routine EEG. A checkered pattern visual stimulus is used for what's called the visual evoked response.
Okay.
So. Not clear.
Perry, I agree with Steve. I mean, I think the only thing we could conclude is that, you know, that you're a freak.
That, right, and that your memory is totally flawed.
Right. No,
but we do that.
No doubt why I was subjected to this battery of tests.
They thought you were hyperactive?
Yeah, I believe that's why the school sent me there. They thought I was
you torturing cats or something?
No. It was a class clown. They felt that needed doctor intervention.
I see.
Well, Perry, was that in your demolition derby days or before
No,
that?
Pre. That was pre.
Pre Dr. Demo.
Yeah, pre Dr. Demo. It was they did all kinds of tests. They read a bunch of numbers to me, and I'd have to say them forward, and then she read more, and I'd have to say them backwards. I did really good on that one, and stuff like that. You know. Made me lick my lips, and I remember when she went out of the room, I looked at the thing, and she wrote down, mouth awkward. That's nice. I have an awkward mouth.
I have no idea what that is. Did it make you hyperventilate?
Yeah, I don't recall having to hyperventilate.
That's another one that could induce seizures.
I do not recall that particular test, no. I don't know what it was. They were probably doing a program at the time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody knew somebody at the school, so who knows? I don't know.
You were just a nonconformist even back then. They had to single you out.
I'm telling you, one of these days I want to look up those tests and see what they were all about.
Yeah, I wonder if they still have the records.
Days.
I think they're only required to keep medical records for like 7 years or something.
You know, so.
But did that go in its permanent record?
I doubt it.
Yeah, it's right here.
How about my school record? How long do you think my high school is going to keep my records?
I have no idea.
You might be there.
Depends on if they have a system for warehousing them, you know, or not.
1980, 25 years ago? I don't know. It's a long time.
I don't know.
We'll see.
The other day, to change topics, the other day my six-year-old daughter was looking up at the sky and noting the first star of the evening, and I explained to her that that star was actually a planet. She was looking at Venus.
Yeah. Rachel's been saying the same thing lately.
Yeah, Venus is very bright in the western sky at this time, shortly after sunset. You know, obviously Venus is closer to the sun than the Earth, so from our perspective, Venus tends to hug the sun in the sky, which means it's usually either visible after sunset for a few hours or maybe visible just before sunrise in the morning, depending on whether or not what side of the sun it's on. So right now, Venus is bright after sunset in the western sky. It is, in fact, the third brightest object in the sky after the sun and the moon. And because it's not always there, it can be an unexpected object in the evening sky. So... My daughter now takes great pleasure in pointing Venus out to me every time she sees it in the evening. But it reminds me of the fact that Venus is, in fact, the single most often object that is mistaken for a UFO, for an unidentified flying object.
Mm-hmm.
And I found an article about just such a case recently, just a few days ago. This is reported in Orlando. The Martinez family spent the better part of 4 hours trying to identify the object hovering in the western sky Saturday night, alternately displaying red, green, blue, and yellow lights.
Mm.
So again, they were seeing a point of light in the sky. It was available. It was visible in the evening. they.
I didn't know Venus changed all those colors.
Well,
it does. That's their overactive imagination.
That's true. It could just be just you stare at something long enough, and you know there could be certain visual effects. But an astronomer quoted in the same article commented, which
pollution
is true.
Pollution in the sky. Or
that, yeah, that light refracting off the atmosphere can alter the color of the planet of Venus, so it can appear, you know, more red shifted or more blue shifted in terms of the way the light's reflecting off the atmosphere. So that is in fact not an uncommon phenomenon. But
now, Steve, is it true that staring at Venus can cause seizures? Is that is that accurate?
Well, stars do not twinkle. I mean, planets do not twinkle. Stars do twinkle. Maybe if you stare at a twinkling star long enough, you might have a seizure. Bobby, you were saying?
I mean, that thing, Venus mystified them for 4 hours?
Apparently.
Wow.
There wasn't a lot going on that night.
No, it was a slow night.
Nothing on the tube.
Yeah, but, you know, of course, they were convinced it was a quote-unquote UFO, you know, meaning some kind of alien phenomenon. They were calling UFO groups, calling the police, you know, trying to figure out what it was. They said it wasn't an aircraft. It wasn't an airplane.
They called an astronomer. They could have stopped right there.
That's right. Right.
They called everyone but.
Now, I could kind of see if you're in a car and you're looking at it, it appears, you know, like the moon, it appears to be moving with you because it's so big and so far away. You know, the relative positions don't change enough for you to see, you know, so it seems like it's following you. Now, I could kind of see that, but... You know, the moment you stop and look at it, like, wait, it's not moving now, and it's not doing anything. And 4 hours later, it's still not doing anything. So I think you kind of figure, well, maybe it's a star or a planet.
Right. The moon is actually frequently confused for a UFO. You think the moon, you know, don't people recognize the moon? But often...
If it's overcast enough...
Even a little bit overcast...
Hazy night,
It could distort the way the moon appears. If it's late at night, you know, the shape of the moon may be unusual. The horns may be pointing in a way that's you're not used to seeing. And again, it also will... If you're driving in the car... Maybe you're seeing the moon through the trees or again through the haze. It can appear to be a oddly shaped glowing object that's following you. That appears to be following you. So it's again very commonly reported as or mistaken for a UFO.
Yeah, it looks a little different during a lunar eclipse as well. It sort of takes on a new texture.
A ruddy or red color. Mm.
This is of course when it's helpful to have a. Well-defined skeptical toolkit with you and be able to perhaps use one of the items therein too.
Right, like, so Occam's razor is a good tool to pull out.
There you go.
Love it.
It's a point of light in the sky I can't identify.
Exactly.
So we'll be getting these Venus UFO reports for the next couple of months until it dips back again below the horizon. Then it will make an appearance in the morning sky. Where it even looks more unusual. I think it's probably more likely to be reported as a UFO when it appears in the morning sky just before sunrise because of it's more of an unlikely object at that time as opposed to just a bright star.
Yeah, but don't worry. But when it is out of our horizon and our range again, Jupiter will take over as the point of light that people will mistake for a UFO at that point.
All right.
That's another common one. Not as common as Venus, I think probably because it's not as bright as Venus is. But Jupiter is, you know, there are countless man-made satellites. Occasionally, if you have a really clear night and you look up at the sky,
shuttle or satellite.
You look for small, you know, relatively dim points of light in the sky. Just you know, scan for, you know, various different star-like objects, and fairly quickly you'll find one that is actually moving across the sky fairly quickly.
At a pretty good clip. I love finding satellites.
Yeah, they're satellites. They're obviously way too high to be a plane or anything else. They're just a point of light. And it is interesting how quickly they're moving across the sky.
Especially when you compare it to, like, an airplane, which is what most people see moving across the sky. Those things are going at a nice clip. It's pretty fascinating.
Bob, you've never seen one?
No, I never really spent time looking for satellite. You know,
on a clear night, you know, lay in the grass and look up.
It doesn't take long before you'll find one.
You do have to look, though. I mean, because they are they're not really bright. They're fairly dim, and you have to be looking at them for a few seconds to really to notice the movement against the background of the stars. So if you don't really look for them, you won't see them.
And I find that you find they're a little bit more visible directly overhead as opposed to looking for them on the horizon.
Yes, so that's correct.
Over your head, they appear to get a little brighter, and as they head towards the horizon, they'll fade out.
Right, exactly. They're easier to see directly overhead. Since we're on the topic of UFOs, I came across another article, this one about alien abductees. This was a study performed recently at Harvard University by Richard McNally. Harvard, you know, has a special relationship now with the alien abductee phenomenon. You guys remember why?
John Mack, right.
John Mack, mm-hmm. Who is a psychiatrist at Harvard who had a number of patients who claimed to have been abducted by aliens, and he came to believe their stories. He thought that was the most likely explanation, that they actually were abducted.
So his Occam's razor was dull.
Right. For a psychiatrist to fall into that is really unprofessional and surprising in a way. He basically fell into the delusion of his own patients. I mean, you know, psychiatrists are supposed to learn to avoid doing that in medical school or in their subsequent training.
Especially with the patina of Harvard on his name.
Right. I mean, Harvard was clearly embarrassed by this, but he had tenure and, you know, so they just had to put up with him. And, you know, if you recall, he was killed recently. I believe he was hit by a car in England, right? Not uncommon. A lot of Americans actually get into pedestrian accidents because of
the traffic, the differences.
They're driving on the wrong side of the road, so you look right instead of left or left instead of right.
That is, of course, the cover story.
That's the cover story, right? The Men in Black got him. We know the whole thing, but the cover story was very plausible. So anyway, so now this is another Harvard scientist, a psychologist, it says, not a psychiatrist, who, one of the assumptions in his research, this is, again, Professor Richard McNally, is that people who claim to have been abducted by aliens have a false memory syndrome. He's basically just assuming that, so he's not endorsing the reality of their accounts. And what he wanted to know is, do people who, due to a false memory syndrome for whatever reason, who are reporting a trauma that did not really happen to them, do they have the same kind of emotional and physiological response to remembering their false trauma as people do who are recounting an actual trauma that actually occurred?
That's interesting.
What do you think he found?
I'd say, yeah.
That they were the same.
Absolutely. He found no difference. So in having people who were abducted by aliens recount their alien abduction, they showed the same physiological signs of stress, rapid heartbeat, dilated pupils, you know, sweating, et cetera, as did people who were reporting, you know, more prosaic or established traumas.
So, you know, would you not, if you were an alienist, as someone who believed in abductions, wouldn't you say that this is evidence supporting your conviction?
Yeah, I mean, just that fact alone, you can interpret either way. There's two possible interpretations. One is those were real traumas. The reason why they're the same is because these really happened to these people. The other interpretation is that the belief in the trauma is the only thing that matters in determining the physiological reaction,
right,
not the reality of the trauma. And that was Dr. McNally's interpretation. Some facts that argue against the reality of the abductions. One is that there was one significant difference between the reporters of alien abduction and the reporters of more prosaic traumas, and that is when asked, would you want to go through that experience again?
They said yes.
Yeah. And people with more prosaic traumas all say no.
No.
So that's a pretty significant difference.
Yeah.
He also, interestingly, gathered data on the personality profile of these people. And he said, you know, in his research, Professor McNally identified the recipe for an alien abductee. As he reports it, most of the subjects were interested in astral projection, tarot cards, telling the future, bioenergetic therapies, and, of course, aliens. and this is in quotes, so they had a whole set of New Age beliefs to begin with. So going into, prior to their experience, they had a background of a variety of New Age beliefs. So this alleged abduction is not happening to people at random. It's happening to people who are already prepared to believe in this type of thing.
Seems to be some correlation to the fantasy-prone personality.
Exactly. And, in fact, the next paragraph is, they also were prone to fantasies or vivid images, so-called fantasy-prone personality. And the third thing that highly correlated, so the two things, one is a history of New Age beliefs, two is a fantasy-prone personality profile, and what was the third thing that highly correlated with it? They had episodes of sleep paralysis.
Oh, jeez, of course. Oh,
hypnagogic right. Hallucinations.
Absolutely.
That old chestnut.
Right, which we've talked about before. People who, either upon falling asleep or upon awakening, will have
ghostly,
episodes of
demonic,
paralysis,
alien,
right, fear, a sense of a strange or malevolent
pressure
presence.
On the chest.
That is the recipe, those four things. Those three things, rather. Of course, that, to me, is very compelling evidence that these are psychological episodes. These people are having not actual physical reality episodes.
Good experiment.
Now, Bob, you sent me an article this week about a new discovery involving the evolution of the eye. Can you give us a brief summary of that?
Current biology, I believe it's a periodical, Steve. Have you ever heard of Current Biology?
I don't get it. It sounds like a basic science journal.
Okay. Well, they reported this week that there's a link, that they found a link between vertebrate eyes and invertebrate eyes. They go into detail talking about how vertebrates, you know, mammals have lenses that contains, the lens of our eyes contains a special class of proteins called crystallins. And the high concentration of this protein is what, in the cells of the lens, is what refracts the light and focuses an image onto our retina.
Mm-hmm.
Less complex organisms like sea squirts don't have a lens. They're invertebrates that don't have lens, and all they really can do is just detect light. And this led to the question of how something like a lens could possibly evolve, something that all vertebrates have. A lens is a kind of a bizarre thing. I mean, all it does is refract light and focus it onto a retina. It's kind of a pretty unusual thing, and biologists have been wondering for years, how does something like that evolve? Well, they did research on sea squirts, and they identified a gene called crystallin. It's a crystallin gene that all vertebrates have as well as invertebrates, and these proteins is what refracts the light. They did research on the sea squirt crystallin gene and looked into how, you know, this crystallin protein is expressed in its vision system, and they found that this gene is very similar to the one that that controls our, you know, that we express in the lens of our eye. There's an obvious relationship, and apparently previously unknown relationship between this specific type of gene in the sea squirt and for vertebrates like us.
Right. Now, and so basically, again, from my reading of the article, the sea squirt has, I think, one copy or one version of this crystallin gene that makes proteins which are involved with the development of their eye patch. They're a very simple light-sensing organ. Vertebrates have multiple copies of this gene.
Yeah, it seems like we've got multiple versions of it. And the article was saying that even more interesting was the fact that the genes that control the crystallin gene in the sea squirt can also control our crystallin gene,
right,
which really, you know, made it obvious that there is definitely a link, a deep evolutionary link between,
right, strongly
between
suggests
these
an
genes.
Evolutionary connection.
I mean, they even took these controller genes, the ones that control the crystallin gene, and they put it into a frog embryo, and those genes directed the frog visual system just normally. So
just
it
fine,
was
yeah.
obviously that there's a shared history there. This all kind of is related to intelligent design, and that the article described it as a serious blow to intelligent design, which has long held that a lack of an evolutionary pathway for complex eyes shows that there must be an intelligent designer. And this is just here's another little
right.
another little tidbit of information, evolutionary information that just, you know, just whittles away intelligent design and the plausibility of intelligent design. And this was just a very long-standing argument that intelligent designers have been positing, you know, about the human eye and how they're, you know, how could it possibly evolve? You know, show me an evolutionary pathway for a complex eye, and here's some great information.
And here you go.
That shows just that.
Yeah, I mean the eye is the one of their favorite examples of an irreducibly complex organ. But again, their basic premise is we can't prove a specific evolutionary path every step of the way for the evolution of the vertebrate eye. And until you can do that, there are gaps, and you know, and we need to hypothesize an intelligent designer to fill those gaps. But of course, there's a continuous research filling in those gaps. I remember I argued to that one creationist, Nelson, when we were at that conference, that the problem with the sort of the gap approach that ideas take is that it's a snapshot. You take a snapshot of any science at any time, especially dealing with a complex historical topic like evolution, and sure, there's always going to be gaps in our knowledge, but the presence of those gaps is not an indictment of the legitimacy of the discipline, in this case evolution. That a much more telling picture will not be a snapshot, but a look at over time. Are those gaps static and intransigent,
right,
or are those gaps constantly shrinking? And this is just another example of another shrinking gap in the details of evolutionary history that are being fleshed out. And in this particular case, an IDEA's favorite example for the irreducibly complex organ. So, yep, we have continually shrinking gaps. But, of course, no matter how much they shrink, they'll always be there. When you fill in a gap, you really just make two smaller gaps. So,
right, and how small are these gaps now? I mean, they're talking about, you know, molecular mechanisms and things.
Right.
You know, they're not even hitting the big stuff anymore because there's no gaps that big.
Right, right. They've had to abandon the big stuff. They're
right.
Literally microscopic, and they've retreated to structures which don't fossilize. So, you know, it makes it all the harder to have actual evidence, you know, for the stages they went through. But the eye really is such an awful example for them because
it is.
There are creatures with every stage of more simplistic designs of eyes. They don't necessarily make an actual evolutionary chain, but it doesn't matter. There are examples of eyes without lenses.
They're workable. I mean, they're advantageous for these organisms, even if it's just a simple light patch, a cell that can detect light or dark.
Right. They function at every simple stage of complexity.
Right.
So there's nothing irreducible about it at all. The eye does not have to be this intricate, complex organ in order to serve an adaptive function for the creature.
You know, like, it's not like half a tractor. What use is half a tractor?
Right.
Well, it was never half a tractor. First it was a cart pulled by an oxen, and then it was this, and then it was that.
Exactly.
It has utility at every stage.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I've used that example. I know, like, one creationist quipped to me once, so, you know, what use is half an eye? Were there guys walking around thousands of years ago with half an eye hanging out their head? No, not exactly. No, that's not the straw man that evolutionists are claiming. I said, that is like claiming that in the Middle Ages, peasants were dragging half of a John Deere tractor behind their ox.
Right.
You know, with parts sort of laying out. It's like, as you said, no, it's simpler but functional designs. A plow, and then a better plow, you know, and then, you know, plows that can plow multiple rows at a time, and then
but
a simple combustion
those
engine,
plows.
And then more and more complicated.
Steve, those plows had intelligent designers.
They did.
everything did.
The analogy there is the fact that there was an evolution from simple but functional designs to more and more complex ones.
Right.
But that was a man-made example. So it was, and the evolution was cultural and therefore Lamarckian, as opposed to biological evolution, which is Darwinian. But it's still the analogy is legitimate that
absolutely
when you go from a simpler to a more complex designs, you still pass through functional stages everywhere along the way. You don't when you don't have is the path that is followed is not from nothing directly to a complex design, passing through worthless stages of a partially formed complex design.
The bird's wings.
Right, so bird's wings, you don't go from nothing to a bird's wings, you go from something that serves some other function, some other, where some sort of halfway wing could function.
Right, gliding, thermoregulation, all sorts of
insects.
Trapping prey, there's lots of speculations about what function the proto wings could have served for the feathered dinosaurs that we now know existed in many different species, many different forms, in great numbers. The last piece for this evening is, I think, a topic that we have not touched on specifically before, that of psychic detectives. Perry, you sent me this piece. Why don't you tell me about this, the new psychic witness that is being touted in the media?
The main thing I want to say about this topic is simply that the psychic witness, the psychic, who is said to have helped solve a murder from back in 1993, is a woman by the name of Jan Helen McGee. I've spoken with Mrs. McGee briefly, and she's going to be a guest on our show next week. So I want everyone to certainly tune into that. And she's going to be our first guest representing the other side of many of our beliefs. So
right.
I'm looking very
forward. If she indeed keeps her agreement and comes on our show next week, she will be the first non-skeptical guest that we've had on.
That's right. That's exactly correct. I urge you all in the meantime to look her up. It's Jan Helen McGee. The case was the Weiss case. W-I-S-E was the gentleman that she basically told the police department where to find this guy. She said that he was at a beach, probably Ocean City, Maryland. The police up there were contacted. They looked around, and indeed they found this suspect sleeping in the car of the murder victim. Was arrested and convicted. She's also being portrayed on a Learning Channel special, a Learning Channel program, called Psychic Witness. Apparently, she was supposed to be on tomorrow night, but she
tomorrow
tells me that...
Tomorrow being Thursday the 15th, but...
But apparently it's been moved to Wednesday the 29th.
Wednesday, December 29th.
You can see that piece. Our podcast will be prior to that. We won't have the benefit of it, but we will have the benefit of Mrs. McGee, and she seems like a fairly lively individual, and I'm looking forward to interviewing her with my fellow skeptics. It should be quite an interesting interview.
Yeah, well, by way of background, this is the issue of psychic detectives is one that comes up quite a bit. The public is largely being told, usually by gullible and gushing reporters, like the reporter that wrote this article, Monica von Dobinek, for a local Pennsylvania paper. Absolutely uncritical, gushing article, just ridiculous, that psychics frequently provide significant legitimate aid to detectives in locating missing persons, locating bodies, finding criminals, etc. When in fact, if you actually investigate the background of these cases or sort of delve behind the headlines, no such thing is the case. I think this is a pretty – this one case that we'll go into more detail with Ms. McGee next week, hopefully, the Robert Wise case, I think is a good example. She, again, claims that she told Detective Paul Zechman, where to find this guy. But her, what she says is he was near a beach, probably Ocean City or Rehoboth Beach. Now, this is – so by mentioning those two, you're covering basically like 60 miles of beach, which are local to the area in which they were looking for the person. In this case, they knew who the killer was. They just didn't know where he was. And he was found, in fact, in the car of the victim that he killed. So, you know, all they had to do was sort of be looking for the car, the missing car of the murder victim, to find the guy. So that's a pretty high probability hit. You have to say, you know, you say somewhere along the 60 miles of beach that are right near where you think he would be. And in fact, the murderer was known to be a beach roamer, or a beach comber. So again, that's probably just a high probability hit. The other thing is that, and actually, in fact, I think Randy has an entry already on his website about this, and about this article in particular, that we don't know what the rest of the interview held. You know, she was interviewed for hours, apparently, by the detective. Who knows how many details she gave out? We're right. Only being told years later about the one that was an apparent hit, this one high probability hit. Who knows how many negative or false details she gave that were not being told about? The only way to really know about that would be to actually get the tape of the interview and go through in some sort of systematic or quantitative manner and count the hits and misses. Without that, this anecdotal report is all but worthless as evidence that she provided any actual useful information. Now, we'll try to dig up whatever we can before, you know, we interview Ms. McGee. It'd be nice to talk to Detective Zechman, to talk to the prosecutor in the case, District Attorney Deidre Eshelman. She has some great quotes in this article. She says, "To my mind, any help we can get is good, no matter how bizarre. A lead is a lead," which is, you know, again, just absurd. These cases I find very frustrating just because it's, you know, the distortion of the details and the absolute misreporting and gullible reporting by reporters is often frustrating. They're just, you know, so far off from the reality that is uncovered by even a slightly probing and skeptical investigator.
Yeah, and I'm sure these reporters went out of their way to go get the skeptic's opinion to incorporate that into their piece.
Yeah, this one doesn't even have token skepticism. Often there's a little token, oh yeah, and Joe Skeptic says he doesn't believe it, you know, sort of token skepticism, but this...
not even a tip of the hat to the skeptic.
Nothing.
Oh, she's probably a true believer herself.
Well, that's just, that is the point.
I don't know.
When I contacted Monica to see if I could get contact information for Miss McGee, she said, "Well, I'm not sure that she's going to want to talk to a skeptic."
Mm-hmm.
But then she said Miss McGee did say she could give her phone number out. I know Miss McGee is going to be putting up a website soon, and I think she's glad for interest in herself and
sure, this is her 15
website.
Minutes of fame, you know.
Definitely.
It's maybe a new career for her, right?
It's possible. But we'll learn a lot. We'll learn a lot more about her next week.
I guess anything to interrupt the monotonous drudgery of life is welcome, huh?
Well, we all need a little fantasy in our lives, I guess. Some more than others.
Randy was ruthless about this reporter and about the Learning Channel. He calls the Learning Channel the Dumbing Down Channel. It is horrible that, you know, the cable science programs, Discovery Magazine.
They fall down.
They just, when it comes to the paranormal, they absolutely fall down.
Often. Occasionally, very occasionally, they will do a good, they'll cover a topic correctly. Some producer out there will have done a good show and
right.
Really given you.
They're out there. They're definitely out there. PBS has, like, Scientific American Frontiers,
yep.
And which is a very good science show. And they did a very skeptical show about the paranormal. Bill Nye, the Science Guy, of course, you know, is a great skeptic.
You know, PBS is of course an exception because they're government funded, but every other television station has to make a profit, and that profit margin will always come first. I mean, they've
yeah.
got to draw an audience first.
Now, PsyCop has a show on called The Skeptical Eye. Is that their show?
Yeah, I think that's it.
And what channel is it on? Is that Discovery Science Discovery?
I think so. I haven't seen that in a while.
No,
they have these short, how like 5-10 minute pieces on some specific skeptical topic.
It's good to know. There's not many of them out there. Of course, Penn and Teller's bullshit.
Yeah, that's on Showtime.
That's on Showtime.
That's an unashamedly skeptical show.
That show, you know, it's a great show, but it's certainly very different than what we do.
Right.
They're few and far between. It's pretty much in the same proportion to which most people hold pseudoscience compared to their knowledge of science. It's probably in the same ratio, 99% to 1%.
It's not good.
No. No, it's disturbing.
Yeah.
I blame the media.
They are going to be subordinate to getting ratings. They have to. You know, they have to keep their profits up. They have to get people to stay on their channel. That's why all the learning channels and science, you know, they all have shows about crashes and shark bites and, you know, anything
ghosts.
That's spectacular.
But I think they're missing the boat. I think that people are hungry for real quality science shows too. As long as they're not dry, you know, you don't have to. I don't think we need to have this false dichotomy between legitimately scientific shows which are dry and, you know, exciting, interesting shows which are either, you know, gullible, paranormal, or pseudoscientific. I think
I'll tell you what, you watch The Eyes of Nye, and that is a well-produced show.
Yeah.
It's very entertaining.
Those shows do well. Again, the number one fiction, you know, show, number one drama on television is CSI, Crime Scene Investigation. That is a very...
That says something.
Scientific show. Now, of course, it's also a police drama, but still, the science on that show is good. And they even occasionally, you know, the main character, you know, has some skeptical moments. I remember the episode where they found, you know, a victim who was burned to death, and somebody raised the idea of spontaneous human combustion, and the main character was, of course, totally skeptical of this idea, and he suggested an experiment they could do to involving burning a pig, which replicated a real life experiment that actually
been
done, and to show how a slow burning, you know, simmering fire could reduce a large mammal to ash, basically, and look like the cases that are typically put forward as spontaneous human combustion. So anyway, number one show on television, not pseudoscientific at all. In fact, a very pro science, even skeptical show. I think it's just easy, you know? It's very easy to put out mindless paranormal pap. It really does not take...
The lowest common denominator stuff.
It's not only that. It's not only appealing, you know, to the masses. Again, I think the real science could appeal to the masses, too. But it just takes a lot of work to get the science right and to make it interesting. It doesn't take a lot of work to uncritically present the ravings of paranormal believers without any skepticism. It takes no work whatsoever. This reporter did not have to do any fact-checking for this article, did not really have to try to analyze what was being said, do any background checks. All she had to do was just, you know, completely uncritically quote these people, and she has a sensational piece. But it has absolutely no, I think, journalistic quality to it whatsoever. It's just all too easy. And it's unfortunate. You know, we live in a society that's increasingly driven by media, where people increasingly get a larger and larger portion of their information from mass media. Again, I think, you know, we've talked about this before on this show. The internet, you know, is a double-edged sword, but may, you know, be more of a blessing than a curse, in that it does take a lot of the information power away from the mass media, which has degraded to a large degree to the lowest common denominator. Our show is an example. Now, you know, people can listen to podcasts from there are tens of thousands of podcasts out there on from every different perspective, every different topic you can think of. You know, people can consume hard scientific or hard, you know, skeptical facts and programming. We don't have the audience that a mass media outlet would have, but you know, people who are interested find us. That is all the time we have for the show this week. Bob Perry Evan, thanks again for joining me.
Our pleasure.
Okay,
thanks,
everybody.
Steve.
We'll see you next week. Come and listen to our interview. It should be interesting.
Bob, good job on science or fiction.
Thank you.
Managed to work in Santa Claus.
Yeah.
Oh.
Of course. course, we should have been skeptical about Santa Claus.
Right off the bat.
Well, until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is a production of the New England Skeptical Society. For more information about this and other episodes, visit our website at www.thenes.com. Theorem is performed by Keneto and is used with permission.
Last theorem, let him far from the mainstream. Sleepless nights, slow burn days, problems, proofs, endless delays.